The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to our final podcast from the Edinburgh International Books Festival. Over the last 16 days, we've travelled overseas, across icebergs, up into space, and deep into the human brain. Today, we're showcasing some of the poetry we've heard over the last fortnight. We'll have our own command performance from poets including Glyn Maxwell, Michael Simmons-Roberts, and the Scottish National Poet, or Macar, Liz Lochhead. We'll listen in to the former American Poet Laureate, Kay Ryan, but first, to our own current laureate. One of the perks of the job, apart from that celebrated butt of sack, is that as laureate, you get your very own musical fanfare.
Poet Laureate, Carolyn Duffy.
Thank you, John. The Queen gave John to me. She didn't want him anymore. So I'd like to start with some poems from The World's Wife, which I wrote over 10 years ago, and these were characters, stories from fairy tale or mythology or history or fiction that had informed me as a child and always stayed with me, and I wanted to celebrate them. And the very first of these that I remembered was the story of Midas, which enthralled and entranced me as a little girl. I loved the moment when Midas was given a wish by the gods and asked that everything he touched would turn to gold. But as an adult writer, I felt very queasy imagining being his lover shortly after this wish was granted. So here is Mrs. Midas. It was late September. I'd just poured a glass of wine, begun to unwind while the vegetables cooked. The kitchen filled with the smell of itself, relaxed, its steamy breath gently blanching the windows. So I opened one, then with my fingers wiped the other's glass like a brow. He was standing under the pear tree snapping a twig. Now, the garden was long, the visibility poor, the way the dark of the ground seems to drink the light of the sky. But that twig in his hand was gold. And then he plucked a pear from a branch we grew fondant d'automne, and it sat in his palm like a light bulb, on. I thought to myself, is he putting fairy lights in that tree? He came into the house. The doorknobs gleamed. He drew the blind, you know the mind. I thought of the field of the cloth of gold and of Miss MacCready. He sat in that chair like a king on a burnished throne. The look on his face was strange, wild, vain. I said, what in the name of God is going on? He started to laugh. I served up the meal. For starters, corn on the cob. Within seconds, he was spitting out the teeth of the rich. He toyed with his spoon, then mine, then with the knives, the forks. He asked where was the wine. I poured with a shaking hand, a fragrant bone dry white from Italy. Then watched as he picked up the glass, goblet, golden chalice, drank. It was then that I started to scream. He sank to his knees. After we'd both calmed down, I finished the wine on my own, hearing him out. I made him sit on the other side of the room, keep his hands to himself. I locked the cat in the cellar. I moved the phone. The toilet I didn't mind. I couldn't believe my ears how he'd had a wish. Look, we all have wishes, granted, but who has wishes granted him? Do you know about gold? It feeds no one. Aurum, soft, untarnishable, slakes no thirst. He tried to light a cigarette. I gazed, entranced, as the blue flame played on its luteous stem. At least, I said, you'll be able to give up smoking for good. Separate beds. In fact, I put a chair against my door, near petrified. He was below, turning the spare room into the tomb of Tutankhamun. You see, we were passionate then, in those halcyon days, unwrapping each other rapidly like presents, fast food. But now I feared his honeyed embrace, the kiss that would turn my lips to a work of art, and who, when it comes to the crunch, can live with a heart of gold. That night, I dreamt I bore his child. Its perfect all limbs, its little tongue like a precious latch, its amber eyes holding their pupils like flies. My dream milk burned in my breasts. I woke to the streaming sun. So he had to move out. We'd a caravan in the wilds in a glade of its own. I drove him up under cover of dark. He sat in the back. And then I came home, the woman who married the fool who wished for gold. At first I visited, odd times, parking the car a good way off, then walking. You knew you were getting close, golden trout on the grass. One day a hare hung from a larch, a beautiful lemon mistake. And then his footprint glistening next to the river's path. He was thin, delirious, hearing, he said, the music of Pan from the woods. Listen, that was the last straw. What gets me now is not the idiocy or greed, but lack of thought for me, pure selfishness. I sold the contents of the house and came down here. I think of him in certain lights, dawn, late afternoon, and once a bowl of apples stopped me dead. I miss most, even now, his hands, his warm hands on my skin, his touch. Of course, the original of the Midas story comes from Ovid, great book, Metamorphoses, which was Shakespeare's favourite book as a schoolboy. And another character from that book is Tiresias. Perhaps we don't remember him in everyday terms as we do Midas. English lit students will know that T.S. Eliot mentioned Tiresias in his great poem, The Wasteland. So I suppose Tiresias would have been a middle-aged man, and he went out one day for a walk, and out in the wilds, and on his walk he came across two snakes attempting to mate. I have no idea.
Well, I don't know.
Anyway, he didn't like the look of it. And he stopped the snakes mating by beating them to a pulp with his walking stick. And the Greek gods were always looking down at what mortals were up to, and they saw him kill the snakes, were very angry, and they punished Tiresias there and then by turning him into a woman for 7 years. And then at the end of 7 years, he could become a man again. Not unlike being Poet Laureate. So I wondered if you were married to Tiresias how you would cope when he came home from the walk, thus chastised. Mrs. Tiresias. All I know is this. He went out for his walk a man and came home female. Out the back gate with his stick, the dog, wearing his gardening kecks, an open-neck shirt, and a jacket in Harris tweed I'd patched at the elbows myself, whistling. He liked to hear the first cuckoo of spring, then right to the Times. I'd usually heard it days before him, but I never let on. I'd heard one that morning while he was asleep, just as I heard at about 6 p.m. a faint sneer of thunder up in the woods and felt a sudden heat at the back of my knees. He was late getting back. I was brushing my hair at the mirror and running a bath when a face swam into view next to my own. The eyes were the same, but in the shocking V of the shirt were breasts. When he uttered my name in his woman's voice, I passed out. Life has to go on. I put it about that he was a twin, and this was his sister come down to live while he himself was working abroad. And at first I tried to be kind, blow-drying his hair till he learnt to do it himself, lending him clothes till he started to shop for his own, sisterly, holding his soft new shape in my arms all night. Then he started his period. 1 week in bed. Two doctors in. Three painkillers 4 times a day. And later, a letter to the powers that be demanding full paid menstrual leave 12 weeks per year. I see him still, his selfish, pale face peering at the moon through the bathroom window. The curse, he said, the curse. Don't kiss me in public, he snapped the next day. I don't want folk getting the wrong idea. It got worse. After the split, I would glimpse him out and about, entering glitzy restaurants on the arms of powerful men, though I knew for sure there'd be nothing of that going on if he had his way, or on TV, telling the women out there how, as a woman himself, he knew how we felt. His flirt's smile. The one thing he never got right was the voice, a cling peach slithering out from its tin. I gritted my teeth. And this is my lover, I said, the one time we met at a glittering ball under the lights among tinkling glass, and watched the way he stared at her violet eyes, at the blaze of her skin, at the slow caress of her hand on the back of my neck, and saw him picture her bite at the fruit of my lips, and hear my red, wet cry in the night as she shook his hand, saying, how do you do? And I noticed then his hands, her hands, the clash of their sparkling rings and their painted nails. It's a very tiny one I stole from the diary of the wife of Charles Darwin. Mrs. Darwin. 7th of April, 1852. Went to the zoo. I said to him, something about that chimpanzee over there reminds me of you.
I'm Glyn Maxwell, and I'm going to read the poem called The Bylaws from my new book, Pluto, Never have met me, know me well. Tell all the world there was little to tell. Say I was heavenly, say I was hell. Harry me over the blasted moors, but come my way, go yours. Never have touched me, take me apart. Trundle me through my town in a cart. Figure me out with the aid of a chart. Finally add to the feeble applause, and come my way, go yours. Never have read me, look at me now. Get why I'm doing it, don't get how. Other way round, have a rest, have a row. Have skirmishes with me, have wars. Oh, come my way, go yours. Never have left me, never come back. Mourn me in miniskirts, date me in black. Undress as I dress, when I unpack, pack. Yet pause for eternity on all fours. To come my way, go yours. Never have met me, never do. Never be mine, never even be you. Approach from a point it's impossible to, at a time you don't have. And by these bylaws, come my way, go yours.
My name's Liz Lockhead. I'm Scotland's Macker, or National Poet. This is a little dramatic monologue in the voice of somebody that doesn't really have a voice. Just a little poem. It's called Listen. Trouble is not my middle name. It is not what I am. I was not born for this. Trouble is not a place, though I am in it deeper than the deepest wood. And I'd get out of it. Who wouldn't, if I could? Hope is what I do not have in hell. Not without good help now. Could you listen hard and well to what I cannot say except by what I do? And when you say I do it for badness, this much is true. I do it for badness done to me before any badness that I do to you. Hard to unfankle this, but you can help me, maybe. Loosen all these knots and really listen. I cannot plainly tell you this, but if you care, then beyond all harm and hurt, real hope is there.
I'm Michael Simmons-Roberts, and this is a poem from my collection Dry Psalter. It's called Excise Me. So shattered is my heart from endless pounding at my chest wall to get out, that I give in one summer dawn and cut, then lift it. Cupped in my hands like a half-caught bird, it cools and stills. I place it on the sill to keep it warm and lie down on my bed to take stock of this new thoracic calm. Hours pass, then weeks. The sun through glass dries my heart into a peach stone. Another day, I think, just one more. To be sure, I will recall this stasis so deep I can hear huge clouds of blind fish under ice sheets, spiders in the leaf mould of distant forests. Your thoughts.
My name is Ross Wilson. My music is called Blue Rose Code. I'm touring the UK at the moment, and I'm going to perform a Norman McCaig poem, which was sent to me by a friend of mine. It's called True Ways of Knowing. Not an ounce excessive, not an inch too little, are easy reciprocations. You let me know the way a boat would feel if it could feel the intimate support of water. The news you bring me has been news forever, so that I understand what a stone would say if a stone could speak. Is it sad a grass blade can't know how it is lovely? Is it sad that you can't know, except by hearsay, my gossiping failing words, that you are the way? A water is that can clench its palm and crumple a boat's confiding timbers. But that's excessive and too little, knowing the way a circle would describe its roundness. We touch two selves and feel, complete and gentle, the intimate support of being. The way that flight would feel a bird flying, if it could feel, is the way a space that's in a stone that's in water would know itself if it had our way of knowing.
Not an ounce excessive or an inch too little are easy reciprocations. You let me know the way a boat would feel if it could feel the intimate support of water. The news you bring me has been news forever, and I understand what a storm would say if it could speak. Is it sad a grass blade can't know how it is lovely? Is it sad that you can't know except by hearsay that you are the way, you are the way? I'm a gossip and feeling worse, you are the way, you are the way. But that's excessive and too little, knowing the way a circle would describe its roundness. We touch two cells and feel complete and gentle, the intimate support of being. The way that flight would feel a bird flying is the way a space that's in a stillness in the water would know itself if it had our way of knowing, if it had our way of knowing. And is it sad that you can't know except by hearsay that you are the way, you are the way? I'm a gossip and feeling worse, you are the way, you are the way. Oh, but a water is that can clench its palm and crumple, and boats can fight in timber. I'm a gossip and feeling worse.
That was the Norman McCaig poem, True Ways of Knowing, set to music by Blue Rose Code, also known as Ross Wilson. Finally, we're going to hear some extracts from Kay Ryan's event here at Edinburgh. She's the former Poet Laureate of America, and she provided one of the best lines of the festival. I'd like to beat people around the head with lightness, she said, but you can't, because you have to stay light. She follows this maxim in her own poetry, which manages to be both light and profound.
I thought I would begin with my only actual Scottish tribute poem. So this is called Osprey. The great taloned osprey nests in Scotland. Her nest's the biggest thing around. A spiked basket with hungry, ugly osprey offspring in it. For months she sits on it. He fishes, riding 4-pound salmon home like rockets. They get all the way there before they die, so muscular and brilliant, swimming through the sky. Now, this poem is inspired by Ripley's Believe It or Not, volumes to which I have often returned for inspiration. In this case, a plain, ordinary steel needle can float on pure water. Now, probably some of you tried that as children, where you would float a needle on top of water. Is that in a water glass? Anybody do it? Yes? Yes, oh, thank God. Somebody has, yeah, yeah. So here's the poem. Who hasn't seen a plain, ordinary steel needle float serene on water as if lying on a pillow? The water cuddles up like jello. It's a treat to see water so rubbery, a needle so peaceful. The point encased in the tenderest dimple. It seems so simple when things or people have modified each other's qualities somewhat. We almost forget the oddity of that. I was, to use one of your terms, gobsmacked to learn that a number of people have used this as a wedding poem. Isn't that wonderful? You know, sometimes I don't have much faith in people, and I'm wrong not to have faith in people. Now, this poem is called Winter Fear, and I thought it would be a good poem for this climate. This can happen anywhere. Is it just winter, or is this worse? Is this the year when outer damp obscures a deeper curse that spring can't fix? When gears that turn the earth won't shift the view? When clouds won't lift, though all the skies go blue? So this is called When Fishing Fails. It sounds kind of Yeatsian at first, but don't get your hopes up. When fishing fails, when no bait avails, and nothing speaks in liquid hints of where the fishes went for weeks, and dimpled ponds and silver creeks go flat and tarnish, it's nice if you can finish up your sandwich, pack your thermos, and ford this small hiatus toward a second mild and absorbing purpose. This poem, I almost gave this poem a subtitle and called it an incantation, but I hope that it would be just be obvious that it is, in a sense, an incantation. It's called Deer, and it seems to be about deer, but it's actually about trying to get going, which is, for a writer, and for any, I think all of us in every aspect of life, about the hardest thing to do. And if you can get going, something can get happening. This is getting something going, that process of making something begin. Deer. To lure a single swivel ear, one tentative twig of a leg, or a nervous tail here, is to mark this place as the Emperor's Park, rife, I say rife with deer. For if one leaf against the littered floor be cleft with the true arc, all this lost ground and more becomes a park. Everywhere the nearest deer signals the nearest dark. A buck looks up. The touch of his rack against wet bark whispers a syllable singular to deer. The next one hears and lifts. The next one, the next head stops and shifts deeper and deeper into the park. Another animal poem. This poem is called Turtle, and it comes from a time when I was terribly frustrated. And that was a very long time, so I had plenty of time to write this poem. It's almost like a bunch of set mouse traps. There are so many metaphors waiting to go off in it. It's too packed, it's kind of enjammed. It's the body of frustration. I was having to have a kind of patience that I didn't have. Turtle. It also has my greatest rhyme in it, where one word rhymes in the following line with three words. Who would be a turtle who could help it? A barely mobile hard roll, a four-oared helmet. She can ill afford the chances she must take in rowing toward the grasses that she eats. Her track is graceless, like dragging a packing case places, and almost any slope defeats her modest hopes. Even being practical, she's often stuck up to the axle on her way to something edible. With everything optimal, she skirts the ditch which would convert her shell into a serving dish. She lives below luck level, never imagining some lottery will change her load of pottery to wings. Her only levity is patience, the sport of truly chastened things. One of the emotions that I think should be installed in the pantheon of the great emotions is relief. I think it's under-celebrated. Relief. We know it is close to something lofty. Simply getting over being sick or finding lost property has in it the leap, the purge, the quick humility of witnessing a birth, how love seeps up and retakes the earth. There is a dreamy, wading feeling to your walk inside the current of restored riches, clocks set back, disasters averted. Thank you.
And that's it from us here at Edinburgh this year. We'll be back on Friday with Margaret Atwood's book club session on The Blind Assassin with John Mullen. Until then, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.